WFNI, 93 WIBC, HD2, Indianapolis.
From the racing capital of the world. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For Allenser, winner of the...
Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Contact wins it by less than 1/10 of a second.
Now, here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee.
Back at the world's greatest race course on the eve of qualifying. We got washed out a little bit earlier today, but still a lot of activity on Fast Friday, about 3.5 hours, a little more than 3 hours of practice today. And we flirted with 2:30, probably would have gotten there if it wouldn't have rained. EJ Viso, quickest 229.537. Tomorrow morning, gates open at 6:30, practice 8 to 10. Qualifying starting at 11, Fast 9 shootout 4:30 until 6. Coverage all day long here on 1070 The Fan and FM 107.5. And for the mid portion of the day, Mark Janes will be here along with Donald and Michael Young and Mike Thompson on Pit Road, I believe. And, of course, Mike King and the IMS Radio Network contributing throughout the day as well. So a lot of good stuff. And we encourage you to DVR what's happening on the NBC Sports Network all weekend, too, and take a look at some of the good features we have. All right, the last guy was long-winded. He went way long on that show, so let's get into it, Donald, and get right to our callers. And we start with Joe and Fishers. And, by the way, the number is 239-1070. When somebody hangs up, that's your cue to call in. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, Joe.
I got a question about Parnelli Jones's early years, like, you know, before he won the 500. Could you talk a little about that?
Sure. Jalopies, I guess, was what they used to call them in California. In fact, J.C. Agajanian once said that the first time that he ever was aware of Parnelli Jones was watching stock car races or jalopy races on TV on a Saturday afternoon. He ran with CRA, California Racing Association, which started as a track roadster organization and went to sprints by the time he came into it. And then he traveled with Jim Herdebees back to run some IMCA races in 1960. He ran for Val Miletich with a Ford in the Southern 500, I think, in 1957, which is way earlier than most people would think that Parnelli ran NASCAR. But I think what really put him on the map was running the IMCA sprints in, it'd be late 59. He and Herdebees went from CRA to IMCA races in Minnesota and Iowa. And then in 1960, when they showed up at the Speedway, they came together. They were very close friends, closer than I think most people realize now. But Herdebees had a car, the Travelon Trailer Special, and did the one and four lap qualifying records. Well, Parnelli was there and actually shows in some of the shots wearing a blue sweater. He had been offered cars to drive and apparently declined. He wanted to just do the whole circuit and then come back and run Indianapolis for the first time with the year of championship racing under his belt. But he ran he won an IMCA sprint race at Winchester, I think, in the middle of May of 1960. And then he ran the Little 500, as did a lot of people, and not the Little 500 bicycle race, but the Little 500 sprint race at Anderson. And Ronnie Duman won the race, but Parnelli was second. And then I think the very next week is when he then switched to USAC, and then he went on to win the Midwest Sprint Car Championship. And that was the last year for the sectional champions with the... They were running a Midwest Championship and an Eastern Championship, which was mostly dirt tracks. And the Midwest was Salem, Winchester. They weren't running Fort Wayne anymore. And I'm missing one, Dayton, occasionally. Anyway, so Parnelli won the championship there. And then also, he ran some Indianapolis cars, championship cars. I think I still call them Speedway cars. And he ran, I think he ran the Milwaukee 100 in June, but what really put him on the map was the Milwaukee 200 in August of 1960, and he finished second, and he had a car that had arrived at the Speedway. It was a Quinapoli car that was the Braun Plywood Special, and it had arrived, it was entered for the 500, and Bill Cheeseburg, I think, was the assigned driver, but anyway, he was the guy that got in it. But the car arrived so late, I think it was like the afternoon of the last qualifying day when it arrived at the track. So during the summer, Parnelli had an opportunity to drive the car in tire tests, even although he hadn't driven in the 500 yet. And so he ran the tire test with this Quinapoli car, and Tony Bettenhausen, who was going to drive for J.C. Agajanian, he was going to drive what ended up being Calhoun in 61. And he said, do you mind if I take a ride in that thing? And so he got in, Firestone tire test, and ran a few laps, came in, and went to Lindsay Hopkins and said, if we could get that car, I think we could win the pole and the race, or words to that effect. And so so Parnelli was out of a ride. That's how Parnelli ended up driving for Agajanian. Not that he wouldn't have ended up doing that anyway. But then the car that became the Autolite Special, that Tony Bettenhausen actually did a 149.8 and came within a blink of doing the first 150. And had he not, ifs and buts of motor racing, had he not tried to help out his friend Paul Russo and take laps in the car that was Russo driving and then lose his life while doing that, it's very possible that Tony Bettenhausen could have won the pole the following day and done the first 150-mile-an-hour lap. But anyway, the car that he drove was originally to be Parnelli's, and Bettenhausen managed to take it away from him. But then, of course, then Parnelli ended up having a very successful run, amazingly successful run with J.C. Agajanian.
Okay. Good stuff. Parnelli is here this week, and he's going to be here featured the day before the race. So, and by the way, we've got Robin Miller did a sit-down with Parnelli last night that I think is going to air on the NBC Sports Network on Sunday afternoon. I'm told some pretty good stuff with that.
I had a pinch me a moment, if I could just grab a moment here, that Parnelli was in the museum when I was escorting a lady around. And, in fact, the lady that's going to be the hostess for ABC,
Lindsay Zarniak,
I was taking her around, and she said, you know Patty Parsons? And I said, yes. And this is Johnny Parsons, one of Johnny Parsons' senior's daughters.
Okay.
And she said, I do her makeup. Oh, she does my makeup, I should say. So anyway, while we were talking, in comes Parnelli Jones. And so they started in conversation, and then somebody came up to me and said, Paul Goldsmith is up the front to see you. And so I said to Parnelli, don't go anywhere. I've got a surprise for you. And I went to Paul Goldsmith and I said, here, come with me. I've got a surprise for you. And to see the two of those meet, and I've just shared that with several people this afternoon. What fantastic. I mean, I'm just getting goosebumps just thinking about it. These two iconic drivers who had so much in common and were great rivals in stock cars, but then also the fact that both of them came from fairly humble beginnings and became fabulously successful as businessmen with apparently just street smarts. But anyway, that was really special. Parnelli Jones and Paul Goldsmith, that's about as iconic as you can get.
Good stuff. More of your calls for Donald coming up. The Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, FM 107.5 with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee, and Kim in Indianapolis is up next. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Donald. Hey, I've got a question. I don't know if this is in your realm of knowledge, but I was curious about the Speedway Motel and was curious when it opened and, you know, if it was a popular place for drivers to stay.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that was your question?
Yes.
Okay, it opened in 1963, and I did know the date at one time. Was it April the 17th, or it might have been a little bit earlier than that, but not much. So it was like approximately Easter of 1963, And I think it was in, encouraged the building of by the fact that the there was a Holiday Inn across the street, which opened in, I think, February of 1960. But prior to that, there was no hotels out here. It was just the big old hotels downtown, and then you had the motels on 40. But anyway, when the Holiday Inn opened across the street, I think that Tony Holman and his cadre probably thought, well, maybe we should do our own. So what I cannot tell you is exactly when it closed, except it was probably about, maybe 4 years ago, I think, and it was right before Christmas when they announced that it was coming down, and how sad that was. But they were having a lot of issues with masonry. Was starting to fall out of the if you walked underneath if you were going into a ground floor room and you had the cement above you that was would be the pathway to go down to the rooms on the second floor, the masonry was starting to fall out, so it was really sad. But as far as the stories, golly, and the people that stayed there, a lot of the stars would film stars. I mean, the ABC people would stay there. Jackie Stewart stayed there when he was the ABC commentator. Foyt stayed there. And many of the Holman guests, like Jim Nabors, James Garner, Andy Granatelli. And when it did close, I know that Roger Penske stayed there. He was very sad about its passing. I know Granatelli was devastated. I know that Parnelli was devastated because they used to leave the doors open and on the backside, and people would just sort of run from room to room to room. I don't think Kathy Penske was too crazy about the Speedway Motel, but Roger loved it because of the fact it was on the grounds.
Sure.
I was just telling somebody today, you didn't need a car. You just got on the golf cart, and you didn't have to hassle with the traffic.
Well, people ask me what my favorite IndyCar races to go to are and work at, and, well, it's the ones where the hotel is at the racetrack. Now, there are many other reasons to like Long Beach, but I like Long Beach because I walk to the track. And there are a few others like that as well.
But it was J.C. Agajanian, Lindsey Hopkins, and when it was built, they actually, and I can't cite an example, but I know that there were some rooms that had a feature in it, and it was because this is the Lindsey Hopkins room, and I'm using a hypothetical here. The bathtub is just a little bit lower because he, you know, has a harder time stepping in. And different rooms apparently were almost tailor-made to all of their the guests.
Now, did the Beatles stay there or just stop by? They stayed there, okay.
They stayed there. In fact,
so the place was only a year old or so.
Yeah, it was September of 64. And the Beatles did the two shows out at the fairgrounds, and the afternoon in the Coliseum, and then at night was out on the stage. And Jerry Baker was the compere for the afternoon, except he was Jack Sunday in those days. And then
Reb Porter one of the others?
No, Bouncin' Bill Baker was
the
other.
Someone suggested we talked about this a week or two ago and said they thought Reb Porter was involved in some fashion.
It was Jerry Baker or Jack Sunday, who was Jerry Baker, and then Bouncin' Bill Baker at night were the two. Anyway, they needed a place for them to stay, and I think they had come from Milwaukee, and they were going to – no, they'd come from Philadelphia, and they were going to Milwaukee, I think. But anyway, they stayed on the backside, and – I did not know that this had been photographed, but there were photographs taken, and a lot more people out there than I thought, because I remember talking with Clarence Cagle about it and David Cassidy, and tell me when I got to stop here, because we're supposed to be talking about motor racing, and I'm doing the Beatles at the Speedway Motel, but it's a great story. They tried to figure out where can we put the fellows, because wherever they go, they're being, you know, the clothes are being torn off, and people are trying to raid the room. So the idea was, well, they threw out a red herring that it was going to be the Embassy House. Was it the Embassy House? That was down on, like, North Penn or somewhere like that. And so anyway, that was just to throw people off. And they had three rooms booked at the Speedway Motel. And they made arrangements with Clarence Cagle to come in off 30th Street and come down through the infield at night, through the North 40 and then down what is now Holman, except I don't think it was called that then, but they took him back to the motel. And Brian Epstein had one room, and the boys doubled up. Can you believe it? Two for a room. And so, and then David Cassidy said that if anybody calls, the thing was that if somebody calls up to talk to any of them, don't put any of the calls through. The official call will be, if the caller says Liverpool calling, that's the code you can put the call through. But give them all to Brian Epstein. So then the story is that the next morning about daybreak, and they had police, state troopers were assigned to the rooms for security, door opens, and out comes Ringo. And he's wide awake and starts talking with the troopers, and one thing leads to another, and they take him for a ride, for which they later got into trouble. And there's no 465 in those days, and he wanted to go for a ride. So he climbed down onto the, you know, down into the basement of the car. They went out onto 16th Street, and there was a bunch of kids out there, but all they saw was just the two or three state police cars come out. And down the road a little bit, and then Ringo sits up in the seat. So the driver's talking with him, and I can't remember the name of the officer that had Ringo, but he told Ringo that his daughter was a fan. And he said, well, where do you live? And he said, well, it's some distance from here. But he said, well, let's go. Well, it turned out that he was north of Westfield. And it wasn't a farm, but he had like a couple of horses. But they drove up. They would have had to have gone up 31 because there was no 465 yet. And so they got to the house, by which time it was like 8 o'clock. They go into the house, and Sunday morning, I didn't mention that. It was a Saturday night concert and Sunday morning. And so they go into the daughter's room, and she's got Ringo pictures all over the wall. And, the trooper says, honey, wake up, there's somebody that wants to meet you, and here's Ringo in the bedroom. And then there was a different versions about whether the wife said, well, I'm not cooking breakfast, it's Sunday morning. And so they went to a restaurant, had breakfast, and the Carmel was very different in those days, so everybody's sitting around with John Deere tractor hats on and looking at this fellow with the long hair and thought, I should have been in the Marines like we were. And one lady said, oh, apparently there's somebody wearing a Beatles wig over there. Somebody else actually recognized Ringo, came over, and I got autographs and everything. So one thing and another, they came back, and they took him out to the airport. They got on the plane to go, I believe, to Milwaukee. And so the state trooper thought, well, there's a wonderful experience, but that's that. And then somebody came off of the plane and gave him a handwritten note. And I'd love to know whatever happened to that. And he said, this is for you. And it was a note from Ringo saying, you know, thanks, mate. That's the most fun I've had in ages. Because they were prisoners of their own fame. They couldn't go anywhere. Yeah. And so anyway, that's the Speedway Motel story. There's plenty more about the making of winning and so on and so forth. But yes, the driver stayed there, and it was a great place to go. If you stood in the lobby, you got to see everybody. In the week leading up to the race, all you had to do is stand in the lobby of the Speedway Motel. You saw astronauts, race drivers, everybody.
Seems appropriate that the Beatles went from Indianapolis to Milwaukee. That is what the closing line.
Oh, yes. That's
and winning. Kim,
very
thanks,
good.
Thanks for the call tonight. More to come with Donald, the talk of Gasoline Alley. 1070 The Fan and FM 107.5. We continue the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Dave and Marion is next. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Dave.
Hi, Donald. Hi, Kevin.
Thanks for hanging on.
it's so much fun, of course. Parnelli and Paul Goldsmith.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, that was great.
Let me switch gears a little bit, but stay in the front engine era. Would you talk about Len Duncan, please?
Len Duncan, sure. Okay, let me throw this one out. On Parnelli, I got thinking, I didn't look this up, we got nothing to look it up with. I think he also ran in the Daytona 500. The gentleman was asking about Parnelli before the 500. He ran the Southern 500, and it was, I said 57, it might have been 56, but one of those two. But I think he also was in the second running of the Daytona 500. And then also, let me do something for the autograph people. I've been giving out misinformation, except I didn't realize it was misinformation. I'd been touting the fact that Hurley Haywood was going to be one of the drivers signing autographs. We now understand that that will not be so. He's going to drive a vintage car on Saturday morning and then heading for the airport. So unfortunately, Hurley Haywood won't be signing autographs. And then the other one, too, I made a big deal out of the fact that Joe Gosek was coming here. Joe Gosek, I think, is visiting the track tomorrow, but he won't be back on race weekend to sign autographs. Anyway, Len Duncan was an East Coast midget driver, ARDC. He ran some AAA, but I suppose mostly ARDC. You think of Len Duncan and Ed Dutch Schaefer being the two dominant drivers there in the 50s. Len Duncan at the Speedway was 1953 with the Ray Brady Special, and he qualified and was bumped, or the Ray Brady Motor Special qualified but was bumped. And then in 54, he did qualify for the race, and that ended up being his only start. I'll come back and pick up on that in a few moments. But in 55, he was back and drove a McNamara Roadster, which he had an accident with, and then was tried to qualify the Ray Brady car again in 55 and 56, and was entered a couple of other times, but didn't get on the track. So the one race that he did qualify for, I think I said he was qualified but was bumped in 53. Then in 54, he qualified, and he was one of the, was he like about the 11th fastest? And it was an old car, a big heavy tank of a race car. And he finished 31st with a relief driver. And you think, well, if you only, you know, if you were 31st, why would you need a relief driver? Yeah, but the number of laps that he completed, because Bill Hohmeyer was 33rd with 74 laps, and he was the only person out in the first half. So I think that Len Duncan finishing 31st, I think he had like 110 laps or so, but George Fonder, another East Coast driver, was the relief driver. Anyway, a couple of side notes about Len Duncan, and that is that in this story, I think, kind of grew legs a little bit. Some publications or some biographies would list him as Harry Truman's personal chauffeur during World War II. Well, not exactly, but he did chauffeur Harry Truman. And he was stationed in London with the army. And there was Harry Truman was going to land at I assume, Heathrow, and needed to be brought into central London somehow. And Len Duncan apparently got the job for that. Now, I don't know if it happened a second time. So being Harry Truman's chauffeur makes it sound like it's a little bit more than it was. The other thing, too, is that he was one of Mario's early heroes, because Mario ran ARDC in 1963. Uh-huh. And I remember that that one day he showed up here. Len Duncan showed up here. And it was a day... This was probably 1985, and Mario was a guest on the talk of Gasoline Alley. But when we were on at 6 and we were in the garage area, we could do interviews. And I remember just asked the question that had, it doesn't always work out, but this one had a lovely answer. I had met Len Duncan that day for the first time. And so when Mario was on the show, I mentioned that Len Duncan had been at the track that day, and he said, yes, I saw him. And then he proceeded to do a minute or so on how much of a hero that Len Duncan had been, because he handled himself was a clean driver, but also had class and was somebody to have as a role model. Okay, Dave?
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks very much indeed for calling.
Thank you very much.
Jay in St. Paul is up next on 1070 The Fan with Donald.
Hello, Jay.
Hello, Donald.
Yes, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Good.
I had maybe a short question for you, and I hope I didn't ask this before, but I wanted to know, which Indianapolis 500 did it take the longest for first place to lap last place?
Oh, golly. Well, I don't know that I could answer that one.
I mean, are we just talking about the quickest somebody got lapped then?
Well, I could...
last year,
I'm going to
laps to the Lotus cars last
year.
Well,
not quite. A few comments here. I think there was one of the quickest that I remember was 1990, I think it was, where Fittipaldi was lapping the tail enders in about seven laps. Last year, they didn't get laps.
It did make it. They parked and they lasted about 10 or 11 laps.
Yeah, and I have to say, and I was very sad about that at the time, and I still am, the fact that they got black flags so early, and whether there was an agreement or not. But I think Lacey did 11 or 12 laps, and then a couple of them were disallowed because he didn't come in right away. And I think that... but they were still some distance from being lapped. Because I was playing with some figures at the time, and I was really disappointed because I think I figured out that he could probably that the speed that whoever was leading was going, and the speed that Alese and Simona were doing, that they would have been lapped in about 14 laps, and if the race had gone green to checker with no caution at all, which wouldn't happen, but I don't remember what the figures were now, but I think it would have been that Alese could have been like 186 or 187. Didn't strike me that bad, but they didn't get black flag for getting in the way. They got black flag before they had an opportunity to be in the way. But as far as the longest for somebody to be lapped, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm thinking that there's reasons why it's kind of a gray area, because if you have a yellow, then obviously you're safe, and then I'll really get myself in trouble.
So obviously we're talking something in the last 30 years type thing.
It would have to be it would have to be under a green situation. It would have to be a race that didn't have a yellow.
Yeah.
Because obviously if you have a lot of yellows, then you're protected from being lapped because they pack up now.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. Sorry we can't give you a specific answer. More to come with Donald on 1070 The Fan. With Donald Davidson, it's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, FM 107.5, and Eric and Vincennes is next.
Yes,
hello, Eric.
I enjoy you guys' work. I wanted to ask you, am I correct, Donald, that is this the 60th anniversary of flag-to-flag coverage on what we know now as 1070 The Fan?
Yes.
And didn't we also lose a good one in Ron Carroll last year? I want you to comment on that. And I think
all right, then. Actually, yeah, 1953 was the first year, and I had been perpetuating a myth because 1952 was the year that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network was formed. And the articles used to read that was the creation of flag-to-flag coverage, and then it turned out, the late Charlie Brockman told me one time, he said, no, that's not true, it was 1953. I said, well, it's 52. He said, no, it's 53. And what happened was the Mutual Radio Network had been doing the same format for several years, and WIBC was on Mutual. And I think they did 30 minutes at the beginning, 30 minutes at the end, with sort of like 15 either side of the checker. And then they would do updates. And so in 51, there almost wasn't a broadcast because they Mutual had hiked the rates to such an extent that nobody, you know, said that it's too rich for us. So then WIBC said, well, why don't we do it ourselves? And then any mutual station that wants to pick it up could. So in 51, they did that. Then in 52, during the winter of 51, 52, they went to the Speedway offices, which were on North Capitol Avenue, and made an arrangement for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio network. But, as it turns out, they used the old mutual format, which was 30 at the beginning, 30 at the end, and the updates. So the other radio stations in town, of which I believe there were four others, all complained because they had wanted to do something similar, and IBC had sort of pulled a fast one on them. And in order to appease them, everybody, Wilbur Shaw and Tony Holman made an arrangement whereby all of the stations were involved. Now, I think WIBC still did the engineering, but they had at least one announcer from each station on the network, and so you could be heard on your four rivals' radio stations. And so you'd go up and down the dial, and the fact there were only five stations, everybody carried it, so that's all you could get on race day locally. But yes, 1953 was the year. Ron Carroll was, he worked, I think, at, he worked with Mike Ahern.
Did he work at Wire, sir?
I think it was WIRE. Yes, if I can mention other call letters, I believe that was it. So he and Mike Ahern worked together before Mike was doing TV.
Okay.
And so Ron came in probably through Mike Ahern, I would guess. And then I think his total involvement, because he did a number of different assignments, I think was about 20, it was over 20 years, 24, 25 years, I think. But he'd been in ill health for the last several.
Yeah.
He left radio in about 64 or 65, and then he did public relations for the water company for a number of years.
That's right, yeah. I had a chance to meet him several times in the last few years. Very nice man.
Uh-huh.
And he called the spin and turn number one.
Oh, yeah.
Is the one that is the highlight that you hear the most of him. Eric, thank you for the call.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let's sneak in Jason in Ocala, Florida.
Hello, Jason.
Hello, Donald. How are you tonight?
Just fine. You got about, 2 or 3 minutes,
yep.
I think.
Okay, real good. I wanted to talk about, I remember reading Andy Granatelli's book, specifically about the finish of the 500 in 1966.
Mm.
He claimed that Jimmy Clark should have won the race, but that there was a scoring error because Al Unser had crashed and the cars looked identical, and that Colin Chapman was upset about it, and that Graham Hill's team even thought that Clark was ahead of him, and that he thought about protesting, but then he didn't. And I didn't know whether it was just Granatelli's exaggeration in the story, or whether, you know, what the other side of the story was. I've never been able to hear another version of the story or the finish other than Granatelli's.
Well, I could. I don't know that I could do it in the time, but I'll talk fast. He is quoted in the newspapers the next day by having come out of a meeting with the USAC officials, and he was satisfied with the results. And I can tell you also that Sid Collins had what they call a serial score. In fact, I think a couple of serial scores that would sit in the booth actually doing the scoring, hand scoring, as the race was going on. And I think it was Bill Fliedermeyer was the fellow that was sitting with him. And he had Graham Hill as the leading all the time. One version is that Clark spun twice, it is not a version, he did spin twice, and that there was some suggestion that Al Unser in the other car, Al did crash, but there was a suggestion that maybe an Al lap was credited to Jim Clark, but Again, the fellow that was scoring for Sid had Graham Hill leading, and I was up there at the time, so that's not something that I heard about years later. And then also, Andy is quite clearly quoted in the newspapers as saying that I've looked over the records and I'm satisfied that the result was correct, and Graham Hill won and we were second.
Okay. You did that pretty well. That was record time.
One of the shortest stories I've ever told.
All right. Let's see. Next week... stay tuned. Donald, I want you to check my Twitter account to find out when you're on.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. I'll let you know. We're possibly on Monday, depending on what happens with the Pacers. Root for a Pacers win tomorrow night. That will get us trackside at 7, Donald at 8 on Monday night. Otherwise, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. And we know we'll be on Tuesday night, and we'll be on some other nights throughout the week. We know we'll be on Thursday night and probably Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. So then, stay tuned to your local listings.
Tomorrow and Sunday, of course, following qualifications.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. You're on all day tomorrow with coverage here. And then you are up here tomorrow night from 6 until 7:30 and Sunday evening 6 until 8. So that's the upcoming plan. And join us tomorrow morning. Gates open at 6:30. Practice at 8 o'clock, qualifying at 11. Thanks to Skylar Wood for staying late with us. Back in the studio, Casey Vallier. For Donald, I'm Kevin. Thanks for joining us tonight for the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.